you can be there. If you're interested, it's important to sign up on the sheet that's going around, because we need to order books. And we have a good deal on books, half price, maybe $6, $5.50, something like that. And if that's too much, we could even make some other adjustments. So don't let that keep you away. And I guess what I want to say that what I have to talk about this morning, if it sounds interesting to you or puzzling, or perhaps it'll sound simply wrong, that's also an outcome that some of you may have. I'd like to, whatever category you fall into, to encourage you to come to the class, because we're going to have time for discussion, time to talk about this topic, which really is a big, big topic and an important one. And the class is going to be basically an introduction to the biblical basis and the practice of social justice ministries. Last fall, when I started preparing for the class, the first thing I wanted to do was find a good and widely accepted definition of social justice. Well, it didn't take me long to find out that such a thing just doesn't exist. It's a controversial topic with little general agreement, because different people come to it with different agendas, with different experiences, and with different assumptions. But to have a conversation that makes sense, it helps to have a definition. So here's my definition. From a Christian perspective, social justice ministries are compassionate ministries assisting the poor and the vulnerable. That's a very broad definition, and I'm sure there are thousands of possible ministries that fall under that umbrella. But all these ministries can be categorized into one or more of three categories, okay? So here's the first one. Relief. That's direct aid to meet immediate physical, material, or economic needs. Or some deal with development, giving an individual, a family, an entire community what they need to move beyond dependency on relief into a condition of economic self-sufficiency. And then there's a third category, social reform. These are changes in the legal and legislative frameworks which shape the contours of dependency and poverty. And before going any further, I want to acknowledge that although we don't talk about social justice very much here, we actually do social justice. And we have a number of ministries which I think are exemplary. For example, there is the Snack Pack program that Laurel started a little over 2 years ago. It now feeds about 250 students that are in the Potsdam school system, and Laurel says that's about half of the total number that could qualify the program. These are students that come from families that are food insecure. They're not sure that they have enough food to last the month, and so the Snack Pack program provides nutritional support on the weekends when the kids aren't in school and can have meals in the school. It's a very valuable and necessary program of relief. Another is the Transformation House, which provides an environment where women can move from chemical dependency, alcoholism, towards independent living. This is an example of a social justice program in the developmental category, and is now in its third month. And though it's a very new program, behind it are 6 years of work that, hard work, with lots of discouragements and lots of perseverance to change a dream into a reality. Then the third program I'm going to mention, and there are others in the past that I'm going to skip over, not because they weren't significant, but time is short. The third is our sponsorship of a refugee family, Jamila Salah and her three children. Our experience with Jamila and her family came to, an official end almost a year ago when Jamila accepted a professional job down in the Binghamton area and moved her family down there. So for 13 years, though, New Hope people worked with Jamila, first when she was in Eritrea, threatened by religious, kind of a combination of religious and political persecution. We helped her escape from the country. She left her apartment at 11 o'clock Saturday night to go to the airport as secretly as possible. And Monday morning, friends of hers in Eritrea told her that the security police showed up at her door, ready to take her away, not to prison, but to imprisonment. At the time, they were using storage containers for the people that they were persecuting. So Jamila came here as a persecuted refugee, forced to flee her own country with no resources, none, nothing, except her coffee set, and which has gotten a lot of use, and poor language skills. And in 13 years, she's become an American citizen with a professional job and a career and a life. So that was a social justice ministry that involved both relief and development. So that's my first introduction. Now I have a second introduction. Okay. And afterwards, there's even going to be something else. So I've been interested in social justice ministries for a long time. And I was very pleased when the elders asked Ben and I to do some teaching on the topic. But despite being interested in the topic for a long time, that doesn't mean that I knew an awful lot about it. And so for the last 4 months, I've been trying to get up to speed. And I've been reading a number of books, and I have been very surprised by some of the things that I've learned. The most surprising thing I found is that the biblical basis for social justice ministry goes all the way back to God's call of Abraham. So that's where I'm going to start this morning. That's where, more or less, where the course starts. And it's a long, long story. You ready? So I'm just going to work on the first chapter of that story and just on the highlights of that first chapter. And if you want to learn more and you want to learn about chapter 2 and chapter 3, you're going to have to come to the course. Later in the message, I'm going to tell you about the second most surprising thing I learned. That's going to be right at the end, so stay tuned. Now, there's another challenge, aside from the fact that I didn't know very much about social justice and the fact that there is no accepted definition of what social justice is, there's also the problem that social justice is a phrase that simply doesn't occur, at least in the English translations of the Bible that I read. And if I'm going to lead a Bible study or do a sermon, I really would rather do it on something that's in the Bible than isn't. So what to do? Fortunately, there is an alternative. Timothy Keller, who is the author of it's one of the best books I've ever read. It's very clear, it's concise, covers the topic, and it's challenging. Timothy Keller says that there are two Hebrew words, and with apologies to any Hebrew speakers here, they are tzedek and mishpah. And when they occur together, the English expression that best conveys the meaning is social justice. So we're going to start out by talking about those two words. And they are translated usually as justice and righteousness, or sometimes just plain right and just. So we're going to be looking at those two words and then look at the bigger picture of the important role they play in the Old Testament story and what that tells us about the importance of social justice ministries. Now, so you'll have a little patience with me as we look at these two words. It's not the most exciting thing in life, I know. I want to take a look at a passage from Psalm 89. It says, "Righteousness and justice are the foundation of your throne. Love and faithfulness go before you." You know, God is always awesome, right? Yes, I hear Mark agreeing. Okay, we can go on. But God is most often when he sits on his throne, because that's where he issues judgments. That's the official seat of power. It's a symbol of authority. And the psalmist says that righteousness and justice are the foundation of God's throne, the foundation of his authority. Think about that. What does that mean? In what sense can righteousness and justice be the foundation for anything, let alone God's authority? Now, when I'm puzzled about a passage in the Bible, I usually look at our NIV study Bible, or sometimes I call, if that doesn't work, I call John Ault, and he always has an answer. But usually I just ask my wife, because she's closer. And she always has good answers. And Ginny says that righteousness and justice were the foundation of God's throne because they are the heart of God's character. And I think that's the right answer. Now, if I had longer time this morning, I would add mercy to that, because I think righteousness, justice, and mercy are three words that go together and tell us who God is. So, the words. Now, I want to warn you, righteousness and justice, they're words that we use. They're common in our language. But in the Old Testament, they had a different meaning related to the way we use them, but nevertheless different in some very important ways. But righteousness and justice are the best that we can do in terms of translating them from Hebrew into English. So, justice, mishpat. That means that regardless of race or social status, every person should be punished or acquitted on the merits of the case, okay? And that's pretty much identical with our sense of justice. But the Old Testament meaning of mishpat extends beyond appropriate punishment or acquittal. It also means that people should be given their rights or what they are due. So Proverbs 13, I don't know whether I have that on here or not. Well, Proverbs 13 says, defend the rights, the mishpat, of the poor and needy. Mishpat is giving people what they deserve, what they are due, whether it is punishment or protection or care. Righteousness, tzedek, refers to the life of a life of right relationships. A righteous person is right with God and therefore is committed to putting all other relationships in life right. Tzedek refers to day-to-day living in which a person conducts all relationships in the family, in society, with fairness, justice, and equity. To put it a little differently, if someone does tzedek, that person above all has a right relationship with God and with him or herself, and therefore has a commitment to neighbor love. Now, about Abraham's call. The first time righteousness and justice are used together in the Old Testament occur in Scripture in Genesis 19, chapter 18, verse 19. The speaker is God, and he's restating his covenant with Abraham. And so he says, Abraham will surely become a great nation, a great and powerful nation, and all nations on earth will be blessed through him. And then in verse 19, he goes on to add a partial explanation of how that is going to happen. For I have chosen him so that he will direct his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing what is right and just, so that the Lord will bring about for Abraham what he had promised him. And what had he promised Abraham? That he would become a great, his descendants would become a great and powerful nation, and all nations of the earth would be blessed through that. So in some way, the blessing through Abraham is dependent upon Abraham teaching his children and his household, all the people that worked with him and for him, to do what is right and just. Literally, it says, to teach them to do righteousness and justice. Incidentally, that's kind of a funny way of talking. Do you ever talk to somebody and say, you ought to be doing justice today? I mean, does that mean I should be a security guard out in force? I don't know. It's not, we don't talk that way. I can say, I admire justice. You know, it's an abstract notion. Hebrew was a language that did not use abstract ideas. Its nouns were concrete. So that if you talked about doing justice, it meant exactly that. You ought to live in a way that you are doing justice. In other words, you should be acting in a way that is giving people their due, whether it is correction because of misbehavior or it is support because they are poor and they're needy. That is their due. And it's interesting to note also that this is not charity. You know, by definition, I think, an option. You know, you can do charity, you can ignore it, that's up to you. But here God is saying that this is something that you are responsible to do. Big difference. Okay, back to the text. And so the text says that righteousness and justice is the way of the Lord. What does that mean? I think it means that as righteousness and justice are the foundation of God's throne, because they are the core of God's character, God also wants them to be the foundation of the yet-to-come great nation that Abraham's descendants will form. So God is looking forward to this righteous nation that's going to come into being, and that righteous nation is going to bless the nations. But it's not clear in this passage how that blessing is going to happen. That's the next thing to get to. I want to make a kind of little side point here. The way we plan and the way God plans are different, right? I love plans. I've had a plan for my life ever since I was 17. But by the time I was 35, that plan had changed in major ways at least four times. And it wasn't because I couldn't make up my mind. It was because in that 18-year period, I had changed. I became a Christian. That had a big effect on it. And the world had changed. And because of that, the way I interacted with the world in my new self, my plans changed for the good. Now, how does God plan? God's planning horizon is not just 4 years, as mine turned out to be, but he plans for thousands of years. He's got the long view. So keep that in mind. The next high point we're going to take a look at is 500 years down the line, 500 years after Abraham was blessed by God and told that his descendants were going to form a great nation that would bless the nations. Moses is on the scene now. He has led the Israelites out of Egypt, out of slavery. They're in the desert. Moses is close to the end of his life, and Israel is about to cross the Jordan River and go and enter the promised land. And in Deuteronomy, it becomes clear how Israel was going to bless the nation. Moses is speaking to his people shortly before his death, and this is what he says. "See, I have taught you decrees and laws as the Lord my God commanded me, so that you may follow them in the land you are entering to take possession of it. Observe them carefully, for this will show your wisdom and understanding to the nations who will hear about these decrees and say, 'Surely this is a great nation, wise. This great nation is a wise and understanding people.'" Deuteronomy 4. The great and powerful nation Israel was to become would serve as an example to the nations of the blessings that flow when righteousness and justice characterize a society. And the nations around it, which were not characterized by righteousness and justice, would be amazed, and they would want to learn about Israel and its laws. But more than that, they would want to learn about Israel's God. And in the process, they would be blessed as they adopted, as they began to follow Israel as their model. That was the long-range plan. And so social justice was an integral part of that plan. And I think if that was part of God's plan back then, there's a good chance that it might be part of God's plan today. I'm not going to talk about that. That's a later chapter. But we will get to that in the course. So, what were the decrees and the laws that God commanded? I'd like everybody to just take a moment and think about the following. Do a little mental inventory before we continue. When Moses says decrees and laws, what comes into your mind? What kind of, this is just a thought thing. I don't need answers. And then I'm going to give you a quiz. Don't worry about it. There are only four questions, and there are no wrong answers, so everybody can pass. But what comes into your mind? Think. about decrees and laws. Okay, here we go. Did you think of the laws and decrees governing religious practices such as sacrifice and ritual purity? Raise your hands. Hi. Okay. And if nothing came into your mind, that's okay too. It just means there's an opportunity for study down the line. Okay. How about decrees governing how the great religious festivals such as Passover should be observed? More or less about the same. How about decrees governing the distribution and ownership of land? Okay, not so many, but a few. How about decrees governing the availability of food for widows, the fatherless, foreigners, and the poor? Okay, so that's about the same. So some people thought about all four. That's very good. But the main point that I was interested in is how many people would see both the religious and the social justice rules and regulations when they think about the laws of Moses. Not too many. God wanted Israel to be a worshiping society, but equally important to God, and I think this is a really important point, equally important to God was that Israel should be a society in which the poor and the vulnerable were not oppressed. They were to be treated justly and supported in ways that helped them to climb out of poverty. That was part of God's plan to bless the nations. For example, Deuteronomy 10, verses 18 and 19 says that God defends the cause of the fatherless and the widows, loves the alien, giving him food and clothing. And because of that, you are to love those who are aliens, for you yourselves are aliens in Egypt. They were slaves in Egypt. And God heard their cries because of the oppression that they were experiencing, and he delivered them from slavery. So that is their history. That's our history too, because Abraham is part of, and our history goes back to Abraham, and through Abraham to the Israelites in Egypt. So that is part of our history too. Okay, final comments. The plan with Israel didn't work. Israel did not become a society characterized by justice and righteousness. Just the opposite happened eventually. And eventually it led to Israel's exile from the Promised Land. But I think it's worth taking a look at least some of three. I'm going to look at three different instances from the Old Testament where there are laws that are designed to encourage social justice. Okay. Now, the first one is an example of God. The first example has to do with the fourth commandment. And that's to keep the Sabbath holy. And it's also the second most surprising thing that I ran into. The commandment says that for 6 days, Israel is supposed to labor. And then on the seventh, they're supposed to keep that holy. It's to be a Sabbath to the Lord, your God. And on that you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son nor your daughter. That's Deuteronomy 5, verses 12 through 15. Now, if you look closely at the small print, you'll see that I didn't put the whole thing up there. Part of it is missing. A lot of verse 14 and all of verse 15. Now, this is what I left out. So, neither the Israelites or their sons or daughters were supposed to work. They were supposed to rest on the Sabbath. Nor your male or female servant, your ox, your donkey, any of your animals, nor any foreigners residing in your town, so that your male and female servants may rest as you do. And then there's a reminder that they were slaves in Egypt, and that God has commanded them to observe the Sabbath day. Now, what is interesting to me about this is that second half that I just read is basically a law protecting the weak and the vulnerable, the servants, the foreigners, and even the draft animals that worked the land. It ensured that they were going to have a day of rest. The Israelites had been slaves in Egypt, and I don't think they had any days of rest down there. And so God was saying, part of keeping the Sabbath holy is not only taking your rest, but also giving rest to those who work for you and with you. Today, if we saw something like that, we would say that's a piece of labor legislation. Okay, second example. The Sabbath year, the sabbatical year, rather. Israel's economic life was divided into seven-year periods. For 6 years, the crops were planted and harvested, and on the seventh year, the land was allowed to rest. So you're allowing land to rest, as well as the animals to rest, as well as the slaves and the servants and the foreigners to rest. Everybody gets their chance to rest. Everything gets its chance to rest. But also on that sabbatical year, something else happened. All debts were forgiven. Students? Do you like that idea? Adults? Older adults? We all like that idea. It's not a trivial thing. The third example has to do with the distribution and ownership of the land. Israel was an agricultural society, and land was the basic and most important source of wealth. The basic economic and social unit of Israel was an extended family. Might be 50, 75 people, number of households. And when they were entering the promised land, God said, I am the owner of the land, okay? But I am going to let you use it. And this is the way it's going to work. Every family is going to get the resources that it needs to support itself. No more, no less. So the land was going to be, the wealth was going to be distributed equitably. Now, God knew that it wouldn't always stay that way. And he said, you can't, because I own the land, you can't sell it. But you can if you get into trouble, if your family gets into trouble, maybe somebody gets sick, maybe there's a natural disaster, maybe you're just stupid, maybe you're sinful. I mean, all those things are possible. And so some families would get in trouble and they couldn't sell their land, but they could lend it, they could rent it out, basically. Somebody could buy the use of it for a period of time. Because, and I say a period of time, because every 50 years, all the land reverted to its original, to the original families that God gave it to. This is resetting the table in a big way. Every 7 years, debts are forgiven. Every 50 years, land is returned. So there's no way that there can be generational poverty. And you have a society where everybody is more or less equal. Some people would be falling down, but then they get lifted up later on. It's pretty remarkable. Israel is to be a counterculture, just the opposite of the cultures that surrounded it. Israel's God was a countercultural God. The gods and the cultures surrounding Israel were aligned with the rich and the powerful. In Israel, God was aligned with the poor. Last word. I want to leave you with a thought from the prophet Micah. He lived during the time of Isaiah. It was a time when there is great inequity in Israel, great social injustice. Here's what Micah says. Do what the Lord requires of you. What does the Lord require of you? To act justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with your God. Now, I would like to say that's really great advice, but it's not advice. What does it say? There's that require word. Thank you for your attention.